This Week with George Stephanopoulos starts right now.
Capital attack.
We need to obviously understand the motivation.
One officer killed, another injured. The National Guard swarms the scene. New questions this week on how to balance security and democracy. And
it's big, yes. It's bold, yes. And we can get it done.
Biden's $2 trillion push to rebuild our country.
It's a once-in-a-generation investment in America.
A sweeping plan, a steep price tag. Republicans united in opposition.
It's like a Trojan horse. It's called infrastructure. But inside the Trojan horse is going to be more borrowed money and massive tax increases.
Biden banking on public support.
I think the Republicans' voters are going to have a lot to say about whether we get a lot of this stuff.
Plus, baseball moves the All-Star game.
It means cancel culture and partisan activists are coming for your business.
The latest fallout from Georgia's new voting laws.
I think this is just the first of many dominoes that will fall in this state.
We covered all this morning with Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, Republican Senator Roy Blunt, retired General Russell Honoré, and our powerhouse roundtable. And
are you changing history?
The battle over military bases named for Confederate generals. Martha Raddatz reports.
From ABC News, it's This Week. Here now, George Stephanopoulos.
Good morning and welcome to This Week on this Easter Sunday. A quiet Good Friday in Washington was shattered this week by the second attack on the Capitol in 3 months. A troubled follower of the Nation of Islam rammed his vehicle into the North Barricade, ran towards officers with a knife before police shot him dead. And this morning, flags at the Capitol and the White House are flying at half-staff to honor Officer William Billy Evans, an 18-year veteran of the U.S. Capitol Police who lost his life defending that seat of our democracy. All this has prompted renewed questions about how to secure the Capitol. So we begin this morning with retired General Russell Honoré, who led the task force appointed to review security in the wake of the January 6th siege. General Honoré, thanks for joining us again on this Easter Sunday. We don't know exactly what motivated the killer on Friday, but it does seem increasingly clear that the Capitol is becoming more of a target than ever.
Absolutely, George. From inside that Capitol, talking to many members of Congress on both the Senate and the House side, both parties, they all left us with the impression the number one mission is to secure the Capitol, but make sure it has 100% public access. This is something that is valued by every member of Congress we spoke to in the 6 weeks we were there, and that they want public access. That comes at with a balance, with re-engineering, with resources needed through the Capitol Police, with upgrading our cameras and sensors and the barriers around the Capitol. That's going to come at a cost. And we've given part of that bill to the Congress, and we need them to move forward now and fund the supplemental that would get this started, George.
But can an attack like this really have been prevented? This seems like a troubled loner.
Well, we've always worried about the lone wolf, whether he's personally motivated or dominated by some ideology. At the end of the day, 24/7, 365, the Capitol Police have to be ready to protect that Capitol. This is the only police force in America that works for Congress. There's no layer of a command between that police force and Congress. That is their police force. It's designed and built to protect that one building. And yet there are those who made snarky comments about, well, they've got all these police to protect one building. Yep, it is the most important building in America because it's the seat of our democracy. If that building and the people in it don't function, we no longer have democracy. And whatever price we have to pay to protect it, we need to do it, George.
You say we're trying to balance security and accessibility. We know that many members of Congress have called for the permanent fencing to come down after the January 6th siege. Did it start to come down too soon?
I don't think so, George. The fencing people we were seeing were a result of post-1-6 as well as preparation for the inauguration. It never came down because there was a line of threat messages that came in for potential activity on 4 March. So the police left it up based on chatter they were seeing. And once that time passed, the reduction in the National Guard was reduced to about a fourth of what it was. And now they're in transition. the architect of the Capitol, along with the Capitol Police Board. We've given them recommendation. The Corps engineer is standing by to reinforce the outer grounds of the Capitol with the contractors coming in to put advanced fencing that could come out of the ground as required, that could provide more sensors, as well as an integration of the cameras. We've given them the plan. We worked the plan hard. Now it's time for Congress to work the plan. We gave them the plan. We worked hard to give it to them. Now they've got to work to make that plan come through, and that's called a supplemental, because the police in the Capitol deserve this. Our nation deserve it, and those families who've lost loved ones deserve it, and we need to up our game in support of the Capitol Police, George.
You did lay out a series of recommendations, including more officers, updated screenings, and background checks. What's most important for Congress to implement right now?
The additional resources. They are going to have to recruit hard. And in order to recruit, they're going to need a special budget to get someone to come and help them run. You know, we are competing against police officers for police forces all around the country, to include the Capital Region. And hiring police now is not easy, George. Maybe 1 in 10 get through the screening process. The Capitol made some adjustments. They increased their recruiting age to 40. That would allow them to take on veterans coming out of the military, as well as extending the age to 60. All of these internal actions they were able to take. But when you're 233 officers short today, you're going to have a problem. And that's been exacerbated last year because they did not get a police class through because of COVID. So they've got catching up to do. They're going to need help. And the National Guard are going to have to continue to assist them. After 9/11, we had 250 National Guard stayed at the Capitol for 2 years. And we may look forward to seeing that happen again. And thank God to the National Guard, all the great work they've done, and hats off to them. And those who are away from their families today at the Capitol, America appreciate the work they do.
We certainly do. General Honore, thanks for your time this morning.
Happy Easter.
And we are joined now by Senator Roy Blunt, Republican of Missouri. Senator Blunt, thanks for joining us this morning. You just heard General Honore right there. He said it's time for Congress to pass this funding.
Well, in terms of a supplemental budget, I agree with that. I think we need to be looking at what our needs are. We need to be thinking about how we're gathering intelligence as it relates to the Capitol and what we're doing to recruit and what we're doing to train. I think that's maybe even more important than the size of the force, as the former chairman of the Rules Committee and now the top Republican on that committee, certainly working with the Capitol Police to help solve these problems and working generally to look at how we secure the Capitol, but at the same time make it as secure as it needs to be, but as free as we could possibly make it. It's an important element of who we are. It's an important symbol of who we are. And we need to keep that in mind with every decision we make.
So no question, this permanent fencing still has to come down?
I think the permanent fencing should come down. I don't think it does the job. In fact, the fencing was right there when the car drove through. The question of how far back would you ever establish fencing? One of the things that General Honore talked about weeks ago was the fact that actually fencing can create a false sense of security on a daily basis, some kind of temporary fencing that can be put up when you need it, like we always secure the Capitol before the inaugurations, two of which I've chaired, is an important element to that event. But I think it'd be a mistake for fencing to be a permanent part of the Capitol. The message we send is the wrong message. Frankly, we're probably preparing for the wrong thing. The idea that what happens next at the Capitol will be what happened last is almost certain not to be the case.
Are we indeed seeing intelligence? I know you have a special focus on Capitol security. Are we indeed seeing intelligence that the Capitol has become more of a target?
Well, I think the Capitol's always been a target. It was a target, I'm sure, on 9/11. It has been a target over decades, and we need to be aware of that. I do think really doing a better job of analyzing the intelligence we have, knowing what we should be prepared for. Frankly, the new sergeant-at-arms in the Senate has a military intelligence background. The new sergeant-at-arms in the House was in charge of the D.C. Guard on January the 6th. They both bring something different to the police board than that board has had in the past. I don't think that board is perfectly structured, but I do think those two people, with the architect, the Capitol, Naval Academy graduate Brett Blanton, who was in charge of building projects at both of the airports before he took this job, Dulles and National, has a great security background. So I think we ought to be listening to them, and we also ought to be looking at what we do to make that police board work more functionally when there is a moment of crisis, and all three of them are distracted in other ways at that time.
Let's talk about President Biden's infrastructure proposal. Your leader, Mitch McConnell, has already signaled Republicans are going to oppose those proposals. But polls show that investing more in roads, bridges, high-speed rail, broadband is widely popular. Any worry that the GOP is on the wrong side of this issue?
Well, I'm actually for all of that. And if the proposal was to do just that, I don't think there'd be a problem with a bipartisan group of supporters for this package. I've reached out to the White House a couple of times now and said, you've got an easy bipartisan win here if you'll keep this package narrowly focused on infrastructure. And then the other 70 or so percent of the package that doesn't have very much to do with infrastructure, if you want to force that in a partisan way, you could still do that. Why would you pass up the opportunity here to focus on roads, bridges, what's happening underground as well as above the ground in infrastructure, broadband, all of which wouldn't be 40% of this package, and that would be a stretch, I think, to get all of those things to 40%. There's more in the package, George, for charging stations for electric vehicles, $174 billion, than there is for roads, bridges, and airports and ports. When people think about infrastructure, they're thinking about roads, bridges, ports, and airports. That's a very small part of what they're calling an infrastructure package that does so much more than infrastructure. That I understand the dynamic of taking a popular title and wrapping it around a big bill that it's a fairly small percentage of, but it's the difference in whether you'd have a bipartisan easy win or a very partisan, broad-based $2.25 trillion package.
But that still leaves open the question of how to pay for it, which Republicans have also signaled they're against the tax increases, the corporate tax increase that President Biden is proposing, raising it back to 28%, which is still below where it was before President Trump's tax cuts. The stock market is booming now. Corporate profits are up. So isn't this a good time to invest in some of those profits in the future? And if not a corporate tax increase, then how would you pay for it?
Well, it would be a corporate tax increase. Of course, we go back to the first or second highest corporate tax in the world, which works to our disadvantage. As businesses are thinking about resourcing, bringing things back to the United States, restructuring how their companies are put together, the corporate tax is an important element of that. Every Republican in the Senate who was there in 2017 voted for the 2017 tax bill, to ask them to turn around and within less than 4 years turn that around is a very unlikely thing to happen. But again, if you went back to infrastructure and looked at the way we've traditionally financed the infrastructure of the country and added to that some public-private partnerships, I've introduced a bill with Senator Bennett in the past and Senator Warner in the past, a slightly different bill that would get us some new funding sources, figuring out how, if you're going to spend all this money on electric vehicles, which I think is part of the future, we need to figure out how electric vehicles pay for using the system, just like gas-powered vehicles have always paid for it with a gas tax. It's a system that you can figure out how that part of the system supports itself. And again, then you can have a bigger, different fight on all the other things this bill purports to do.
Senator Blunt, thanks for your time this morning.
You bet.
Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg is up next, plus our Powerhouse Roundtable. Stay with us.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
If we're looking at ideals and what we think is the actual investment that can create tens of millions of good union jobs in this country, that can shore up our healthcare, our infrastructure, our housing, we're talking about realistically $10 trillion over 10 years.
The last thing the economy needs right now is a big whopping tax increase on all the productive sectors of our economy. I'm going to fight them every step of the way because I think this is the wrong prescription for America.
Debate is joined on President Biden's infrastructure bill. We just heard from Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri. Now we're joined by one of the cabinet members leading the charge for this bill, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg. Secretary Buttigieg, thanks for joining us this morning. You just heard Senator Blunt right there said if you really focused on core infrastructure, you might have a chance of passing this. And it is true that only about 5% of this bill goes for traditional roads and bridges. You've got 20% caregiving for the elderly, about 13% for investments in like the Green New Deal. So why not focus on that traditional core infrastructure?
Well, let's be clear. There's a lot more than roads and bridges that are part of infrastructure. I heard the governor of South Dakota recently saying, this is an infrastructure. It's got money for pipes. Well, we believe that pipes are infrastructure because you need water to live. And too many families now live with the threat of lead poisoning. That's absolutely infrastructure. You know, you talk about roads and bridges, but also airports and ports. We need to make sure that we have broadband. I know that traditionally the internet wasn't considered infrastructure because in the Eisenhower years, of course, it didn't exist. But infrastructure investment has to include looking to the future. Railroads seemed futuristic, and then we actually built them. Now they're considered traditional infrastructure. You could say the same about highways. And I've got a lot of respect for Senator Blunt, but I'm going to work to try to persuade him that electric vehicle charging infrastructure is absolutely a core part of how Americans are going to need to get around in the future, and not the distant, far-off future, but right now.
I know you're going to work hard to persuade him. Didn't get any Republicans, though, on the original relief bill. Is it a realistic prospect to expect Republicans are going to come around now?
I think it can be. I'm having a lot of conversations with Republicans in the House and Senate who have been wanting to do something big on infrastructure for years. We may not agree about every piece of it, but this is one area where the American people absolutely want to see us get it done, where members on both sides of the aisle have been talking about getting it done for a long time. And in my view, this is a once-in-a-lifetime moment. I don't think in the next 50 years we're going to see another time when we have this combination of a demonstrated need, bipartisan interest, widespread impatience, and a very supportive president who is committed, by the way, not just to the infrastructure itself, but to the jobs we're going to create. An independent analysis by economists last week said that this will lead to 19 million jobs. And one of the most interesting things is that a lot of the research is also saying that the majority of those jobs will not require a college degree. That's critically important because of all of the changes that are already happening to labor and to manufacturing in this country to be creating and supporting those jobs for the future. So yes, I think this is something that everybody can get behind, and we're going to keep working to try to earn that support across the aisle. One way or the other, we've got to get it done.
There is some skepticism out there in some parts of the labor community. Sean Steffi from the Boilermakers Local 154 in Pennsylvania talked about this focus on green new jobs. And he said, they keep saying, we're going to transition you into solar jobs. That's not how it works. We build power plants, petrochemical plants, and maintain steel mills. Would you ask Tom Brady to play middle linebacker just because he's a football player?
Yeah, I'm not saying we're going to take a machinist and turn them into a computer programmer. What I'm saying is that we're going to have jobs for insulators on these building retrofits and painters and carpenters, all good union jobs. We're going to have auto workers, union auto workers, I hope, making cars one way or the other. Why not have them leading the revolution into electric vehicles, which, by the way, there is a very hot competition for with China and a lot of other places. We're not talking about extremely mysterious job creation here. We're talking about jobs that already exist that we can understand. If you're a specialist in dealing with mining, we got to cap a lot of mines too, and that's going to create a lot of jobs. So I understand there is hesitation, especially because, you know, frankly, there have been a lot of moments where promises have not been kept to labor, which is one of the reasons why I think having the most pro-labor president we've had in a very long time is going to work very well for workers, and that's one of the reasons why we're seeing workers right there alongside a lot of other advocacy and community groups lining up in support of this bill.
Biggest debates now are over how to pay for it. Margins are narrow. If you don't get any Republicans to vote for those tax increases, you need every Democrat. But senators like Joe Manchin have already signaled that 28% corporate tax is too high. You can't pass it without every Democratic senator if Republicans are opposed.
I think we're going to find a really good, strong deal space on this because, again, most Americans want to get it done. And one of the things that's really striking, you know, I don't spend too much time looking at polls, but I saw some research come back showing that the American people like this plan even more when you explain how we're going to pay for it. And the reason is simple, which is that corporations, we all know, have not been paying their fair share. A lot of multinational corporations have been paying zero on billions of dollars in profits. They're paying more than a firefighter or a school, less than a firefighter or a school teacher, not just in percent terms, but in dollar terms, and that's wrong. So we're gonna reset the corporate tax rate to a rate that is, by the way, still lower than it's been for most of my lifetime, and has been a rate where America has been perfectly competitive for decades. And in doing that, create, again, by some estimates, 19 million good-paying jobs, most of which don't require somebody to have a college degree.
Several House Democrats, though, have said they won't support the bill unless you reinstate the federal income tax deduction for state and local taxes, probably enough to sink the bill if they don't support it. What do you say to those Democrats?
Well, look, we can look at any number of ideas. We know that this is entering a legislative process where we're going to be hearing from both sides of the aisle, and I think you'll find the president's got a very open mind. But time is of the essence. So we'll look at these ideas on how to pay for it. We'll look at ideas on where the investments ought to be, too. But the president is hoping for major progress from Congress before Memorial Day. And we can't allow this thing to just keep dragging on because the need is there today. Each passing day that our infrastructure crumbles, that hurts our economy and it puts our safety in danger. And again, the American people are really impatient to get this done. We're determined to make sure that Infrastructure Week is no longer a punchline around Washington. That's what this robust plan will do, and it's time for action.
And to those progressives like AOC, we showed her at the top, she says $10 trillion is needed right now. This isn't big enough. Your response?
Yeah, there are obviously a lot of people on the other side of the aisle saying this is too big, too bold. And then some of our friends on our side of the aisle are saying it should be even bolder. Again, that's a natural part of this conversation in this process. But let me stress, this is the biggest investment in American job creation proposed or if achieved since World War II. This is a huge deal. And what it would mean to have 10,000 bridges around America replaced, what it would mean or improved, what it would mean to get broadband out to every single American, what it would mean to have zero lead pipes remaining in those water service lines is absolutely enormous, as is that 19 million job figure.
Secretary Buttigieg, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Major League Baseball put the wishes of Stacey Abrams and Joe Biden ahead of the economic well-being of hardworking Georgians who are counting on the All-Star game for a paycheck.
You can't expect to take these extreme actions that limit access to the right to vote when we have talked so much about expanding access to our democracy and not expect that people like Major League Baseball will not take action in return.
Latest fall from that new Georgia voting law, Major League Baseball moving the All-Star game. One of the things we're going to talk about on our roundtable, we're joined by Chris Christie, Rahm Emanuel, the CEO of Democracy for America, Yvette Simpson. And we want to welcome Sarah Isger, our newest ABC News analyst. She's a veteran of the Trump Justice Department, also political analyst for the Dispatch. Chris, let me begin with you. You have a baseball affiliation now, one of the newest members of the Mets board. Was this the right move for the MLB?
Listen, it's just a symptom, George. It's a symptom of what's going on in our country right now. I mean, let's talk about what the Georgia law is really about, because we haven't had much of that. Dropbox has now become a permanent part of the Georgia landscape. They were not prior to COVID. They are now. Minimum of 17 days of early voting, including two Saturdays and two optional Sundays. You're going to have all voters being able to have multiple ways to prove who they are. Driver's license, last four numbers of your Social Security number, even a utility bill or a free ID provided by the state of Georgia. And voting is going to be till from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. as it is right now in Georgia. This is what
so
we
what
call
it. What is it a symptom of? It sounds
it's
like you're
a symptom
against
of it's a symptom of this, George. And I hate to come in here this morning to say this, because I sat here and listened to the president's inaugural address. And I just want a couple of real quick points from it. Politics need not be a raging fire that destroys everything in its path. Every disagreement doesn't have to be a cause for total war. And we must reject a culture in which facts themselves are manipulated or made up. And Joe Biden's broken his own rule, 84 days. And now he's lying to the American people, George. He's lying about this bill. He's lying to the American people about it to cause the raging fire he said he was going to put out. I'm very disappointed.
Yvette, he did make some misstatements about the bill. The bill basically, though, restricts access to absentee ballots, but it does expand early voting.
Well, I mean, it depends on how you think about it. You know, you have to pick between a Saturday or a Sunday. And what we know about early voting is a lot of folks appreciate, expect, and depend on that weekend voting. We know that Sundays are a time when a lot of churches do voting. So the fact that you have to pick between the two is a challenge. It still does not address voter purging, which is the big significant issue. And there are not enough drop boxes, in fact. Part of the challenge was, yes, you've solidified it, but you know you have not provided sufficient drop boxes for folks. So let's stop and back up and say, first, the motivation was not to do more. The motivation was actually to do less. We know that voter fraud was not an issue. And so this, just the motivation enough was enough. And I don't think it goes far enough. I think that, you know, what we need to talk about is what do we need to do to make sure that early voting is expanded? 17 days is not enough early voting.
Well, Stacey Abrams, was in New Jersey, in my state, praising Phil Murphy this week for a voting law where New Jersey early voting is 9 days. Half of what Georgia is. Yet she's on TV in New Jersey, I saw it myself, saying that this is one of the greatest voting expansion bills we've ever seen. But this is Jim Crow? I'm sorry, George. Doesn't make any sense.
She's not for moving the All-Star game. But, Sarah, one of the things we're seeing here, it's not just Major League Baseball. It's Delta. It's Coca-Cola. It does appear here that corporate America is out of step with the Republican base.
Well, that's certainly true, but I think that Republicans have stumbled on a pretty good message here, which is Delta, Coke, et cetera, these corporations coming out and condemning the Georgia bill, which, as you said, is ridiculous compared to other states. Delaware, Joe Biden's home state, didn't even have early voting in 2020. They won't have it until 2022. They're condemning that. They're condemning this Georgia bill without really understanding it. Joe Biden has been labeled a recidivist liar for what he has said about the bill by the fact-checking organizations. And what about China? We have actual concentration camps going on in China, and these corporations won't say word one about it. And the hypocrisy of that, I think, is very clear to a Republican base that this isn't about whether they feel strongly about a Georgia bill that doesn't do what the Democrats are afraid it will do. And it doesn't do what the Republicans want it to do, by the way. But at the same time, unwilling to say word one about China because that's where the money is.
They wouldn't be doing it if it wasn't in their corporate interest.
Well, you got to put this in a lineage. Also, if you go back 4 years ago when North Carolina changed their laws as related to bathrooms, corporations then took a pressure in isolating North Carolina. That's also the situation here. It's a shot across the bar to every other state that's looking at changing laws. They're trying to fix a problem that did not happen.
Right.
And one of the worst part, that is the fundamental. There was no problem. They're coming up. It's like they're coming up with a solution to a problem that doesn't exist, and it's a shot across the bow to a bunch of other states. And the worst case of this bill, which none of you have mentioned, is the fact that the state legislature wants to overrule both the Secretary of State. For what other reason? I'll repeat what I said last week, which is if Donald Trump won Georgia, there'd be no change in the law.
If and
the
fact Joe is Biden because Joe Biden won, Abrams were saying this, that, I think we'd have a very different right. conversation.
I have no problem fixing
it.
There's a lot of problems to fix. This was not
voting.
A problem to fix.
It doesn't end early voting.
It expands early voting in Georgia. The president said it ended it. Listen, here's what Joe Biden's got to live with when he wakes up this morning on Easter morning. He is doing exactly what he sat around in the campaign and the transition accused Donald Trump of doing. He is lying to cause racial divisions in this country. That's what he accused Donald right. Trump of doing, and he's a liar and a hypocrite. This
wait, so hold on, hold on.
Why Major League Baseball is making the move?
It's a business judgment, George. It's a business judgment. Major League Baseball has to make a decision about what is in their best business interests. I'm sure that's what... Chris, I haven't spoken to anybody but I'm sure that's what it is.
Interest, doesn't that suggest that there's something wrong with the law?
No, what it suggests is that's the climate in this country right now.
You should
that's
ask
the climate
the people
what it
who
is.
Know. You should ask the people who know. I've been doing voter protection for 10 years. Just the idea that you can't give people water in line. I've helped people's
that's
babies...
That's not true.
I have helped people's
you
babies
can't do electioneering.
While they go in to vote in order to enfranchise the vote.
I'm sorry. That's just wrong.
Do it by all...
Well, within 20... I think it's
150 feet, where in New Jersey, in Chicago, and any place else in the country, you're not. He's saying partisan groups cannot do electioneering by giving out food and water. And in Georgia, Bill says that there can be water provided by the state of Georgia, just not by partisan
two things,
groups.
George.
Also,
and
this is the kind of stuff. Part of the bill, but it's not a threat to democracy.
Two things.
Every time you try to restrict voting rights, it's
but
a threat to democracy. And the fact that they
rights.
Didn't address the elephant in the room, which is voter purging. 198,000 African American Georgians.
That's not what Joe Biden and Stacey Abrams have been complaining about.
Yeah, Rob.
I feel like a middle child at a dinner breakfast.
Always.
You really have a hard time getting in.
Two things.
Yeah, everyone feels bad for you,
Rob. One is, you said the corporate America is out of step with the Republican Party. Corporate America has no home in the Republican Party anymore. And this is the first of many times where corporate America is going to make a clear decision, and it's a wake-up call to every other state. Second is, Joe Biden is not a liar.
Yes, he is.
No. And coming from, we just spent 4 years with a person who had literally couldn't find the truth if it actually went choo-choo in front of him in the morning. Joe Biden, you may disagree with his characterization. He is not a liar. You may disagree with his characterization. That bill is only passed for one reason, because Joe Biden won Georgia and the two senators won Georgia.
He lied. He lied, Rom. He's going to have to live with
it. He is not.
Yes, he is.
Let's talk about the infrastructure bill right now. We're seeing the first flurries this week. Sarah Isker, let me begin with you here. It appears that Biden is going to go full speed ahead, the biggest, boldest program, not worried right now about getting the Republicans on board.
And a very different Republican message than when we saw Barack Obama come into office in 2009. They went straight at Obamacare and took what could have been a very popular piece of legislation through messaging and a lot of consistent messaging from every person in the Republican Party, drove down the popularity of that bill. So instead of being a legislative accomplishment, it really hung around the necks of Democrats in the midterms. With the American Recovery Act that we saw last month, Republicans were talking about Dr. Seuss. It'll be very interesting. Mitch McConnell and McCarthy, they want to go after this bill and message about how it's not really infrastructure, that only 5% is going to traditional infrastructure. Will the rest of the Republican Party follow suit? Or are they going to be talking about the All-Star game?
And you just heard, but you also just heard Roy Blunt saying, wait, I love a lot of the infrastructure as well, because they know so much of the individual investments in this bill are popular.
And they're no longer the party of fiscal restraint.
Well, both parties have given that.
Look, I mean, Joe Biden made a very clear statement. If you want a 21st century economy, you can't have a mid-20th century foundation. And if it runs on roads, rails, or runways, we're going to get you there on time. And it's very, very popular because right now in Jackson, Mississippi, you can't get fresh water. You can't, if you're rural America, you can't get your child on the internet for school. And all of us know parents can't get to soccer games or after school activities on time. They have to budget an extra 20 minutes because of all the congestion and all the problems. So it's very popular there. The other thing that he has done very well to the White House, on the relief bill, it was all about COVID. On infrastructure, if you vote no, you're with China. If you vote yes, you're with America. And they're picking the right enemies for each of these battles.
Chris Christie, Republican governor is not in exactly the same place.
No, listen, how many times have we said this on this program? If you're going to give governors, Republican, Democrat, or independent, money from Washington that they don't have to get by raising taxes themselves, amen, baby. They're all going to say it, and I don't care whether you're talking about the most conservative Republican governor in America or the most moderate Republican governor.
There's a born-again Republican right there.
They're going to say, give me the money. That's what governors always do, because then they don't have to raise taxes themselves. But here's the problem, and again, it goes along with the deceit of this White House, and there is no doubt there's deceit. The COVID bill, a fraction of the COVID bill was about COVID. Now we have an infrastructure bill a fraction of the infrastructure bill is about infrastructure.
Oh, but it depends
about
on how you define infrastructure.
Oh, no. Right? Now the care economy is infrastructure, George. The care economy. I don't even know what the hell the care economy is. But you know what? It's now a huge part of an infrastructure.
I think apparently, you do go to services for Easter. You're a little worried out here.
I was praying already for you this morning, Rob. Believe me.
Care economy, feel not infrastructure.
Well, let's talk about why this is important. We know that without ending the filibuster, we're not going to be able to get legislation passed outside of reconciliation. And so what progressives are concerned about is you give moderate Democrats and give Republicans everything they want in that bill, and then how do you come back and get the things that you need, like Medicare, extended child care, all the things that we know are the human infrastructure, the human economy. And so that's why we're concerned that it doesn't go far enough. In addition, we think that we need to make a bigger down payment on climate infrastructure. We just saw what happened in Texas. Last year, wildfires raged almost the entire Pacific coast. So we know that, we can talk about it in a vacuum. We can think about the fact that we don't need to do more. And then we see the real effects right now. You talked about water.
Right.
Kids in Flint, Michigan, and in the rural South who still can't get clean water. We need to make a significant investment, and that's why progressives are supporting the Thrive Agenda, which is $10 million over the next year.
Sarah, question first. Let me come to Ray. Is there a chance, let me ask you the question I asked Roy Blunt right at the top, the Republicans will pay a price for opposing a program that seems right now broadly popular?
Well, again, go back to 2009. If they are able to actually message around this bill, which I'm not convinced they'll do, Christie makes great points. But you're not seeing a whole lot of Republicans make those points in a consistent drumbeat fashion. But what they were able to do in 2009 to Obamacare paid huge dividends in the 2010 midterms. That was one of the biggest freshman Republican classes in history. So absolutely, Republicans have a way to turn this to their political advantage. Will they take that? And have they lost that moral high ground over spending when for the last 4 years they were on a spending spree and Donald Trump didn't care about spending?
Here's the thing. Comparing 2009 or 2010 in the midterm, the fact is this infrastructure is not about health care. And everybody lives through the problems that we have today around America's transportation system, water system, internet, or energy distribution. And that is a real, real problem in America. And people know it has to be
fixed. But does that mean the home health care workers is coming out of it?
But here's the point that I think is important in this. And you get to the point of Republicans. What is designed in this bill, if you even see in the relief bill that was first done, 25% to 30%, depending on what you're looking at, of Republicans support it. White House is doing, and still do, what Biden has figured out is he is driving a wedge between the Republican establishment and Republican voters. He's telling you up front exactly what he's doing, and each bill, major, which is why not only is he popular, but what he has done on both the vaccine, the economy, and Friday's jobs numbers are only going to give him further wind in the sail we got to make this investment, and it's popular with Republicans.
Well, Republicans need to make the argument that this is about 25% of $2.2 trillion goes to what he just talked about, roads, bridges, tunnels, airports, internet. The rest of the bill goes to a lot of other things, which a veteran is totally for, and that's fine. Let's make the arguments on the merits for those things and not call them infrastructure. And the last point on it is this. Yvette brings up the filibuster, very important. The filibuster that Joe Biden supported, fought for, yelled and screamed for on the floor of the Senate for 36 years, he now calls that Jim Crow. What else is Jim Crow to Joe Biden?
But all he's for now is a talking filibuster. He's not for eliminating the filibuster.
Well, I mean, the talking infrastructure. I just wanted to go back to what Sarah said. Here's the reason why I don't think Republicans are going to support it, no matter how much candy is in this bill. They have set their sights on opposing everything that Biden does because that's how they make the claim that they need to take back control in 2022 and 2024. And that's the reason why I think it was ill-advised for Biden to actually put all the things that Republicans want and moderate Democrats want in this reconciliation bill. Because if we can't go back to the well again, now you've got progressives and most Democrats not being able to get the things that we actually need.
Here's the one thing Republicans haven't caught up on. There's the one thing Republicans haven't caught up, which is real difference. 2009 was a financed team induced recession. This is a natural disaster. It is a different permission slip to deal with what's ailing America when you have a natural disaster, the virus. You can see it like how we respond to New Orleans, how we respond to California or Texas. Americans come to help of people who are victims out of no reason for what happens to them because of a natural disaster. 2009 was a banker-driven scandal. And what I will say here, we've lost 500,000 Americans here, back then, Americans wanted to kill 500,000 bankers.
Sarah, okay? The economy is starting to boom. We just saw 900,000 jobs created this week. Does that help Biden's case to get this done or hurt it?
Honestly, I think...
Was that an oi for Passover? Or what was that? Chris, do you want to comment on...
Very well put, Sarah. Very, very well
put. So glad they signed you last week.
You're already a veteran.
But yeah, we still knew what she was saying.
Now she only has 10 seconds left.
All right, both sides are going to argue that this helps their case, that this is part of their message. You have the Republican base saying this is the Trump recovery, and you have the Biden folks saying, without me, it would be less than it is. I think in the end, you have another base election coming in 2022. The same thing we've seen repeated over and over again. You want to talk about the Democrats or the Republicans doing everything to stop Biden? Welcome to the last 4 years of the Democrats.
We have to improve the substance of promotions, et cetera, in the military. But we've also got to take a hard look at the symbology, the symbols, things like Confederate flags and statues and bases and all that kind of stuff. The Confederacy, the American Civil War, was fought. And it was an act of rebellion. It was an act of treason at the time against the Union. The way we should do it matters as much as that we should do it.
That is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Mark Milley, on how the military is confronting racism in its ranks and the legacy of Confederate symbolism in the military. This week, Virginia's High Court ruled that Charlottesville can take down two more statues, and Congress recently created a commission to rename bases named for Confederate generals. Martha Raddatz spoke with two generals who took very different paths to similar conclusions on the controversy.
There stands Jackson like a stone wall, it says, but...
You see me rolling my eyes? It's meant to show that he's a hero. Who was he? He's somebody that fought against his country to support and create a slave society.
Ty Sedgley rolls his eyes today, but growing up in Virginia, he revered Confederate generals. Robert E. Lee was not just a hero to him, but the greatest human ever to walk the earth.
On a scale of 1 to 10, I would have put Lee at about 11. So it wasn't just that I liked him, I revered him, and my entire culture revered him.
That's Sedgley at Washington Lee University, where he chose to be commissioned into the Army at the foot of Lee's tomb.
The altar of that chapel is Robert E. Lee, surrounded by Confederate flags. And then I went back and sat down and raised my right hand and took the oath. And it's an anti-Confederate oath written in 1862 to ferret out Confederate traitors.
Did you know about his history and the Confederacy and what he represented? Did you think about that at the time?
I thought the Confederates were honorable people that lost. It was noble. It was romantic. Oh, my God, I was so wrong because I didn't realize, you know, what they fought for was slavery.
His epiphany came years later, walking the campus at West Point, where he came across the Lee Barracks.
And I just wondered, why are these things named after Lee? And what I found was that in the 19th century, West Point banished Confederates as traitors. They named nothing after them. In fact, they only come back in the 20th century, and they come when African Americans come back to West Point. And that made me so angry that Confederate memorialization is a reaction against integration.
Now a professor emeritus at West Point and on the commission to rename U.S. military bases, Sedgley's focus is on the sullied history of those Confederate generals whose names are emblazoned on U.S. Army bases. Dr. Nadia West knew it all along. She spent much of her Army career at Fort Bragg. Did it occur to you? Did you think about those names? Did you know who those forts were named after?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But at some point, you think that's just the way it is.
And no wonder. West's entire family, father, siblings, and now her son, serving in the military. Dr. West, the only African American, the only woman in her senior class at West Point.
You take an oath to support and defend the Constitution, and then you've got, you know, things named for people who didn't do that. Anytime something happens or some of the ugliness comes up, the comment is, that's not who we are. But in fact, it is who we are unless we do something about it.
Dr. West eventually becoming the first black female three-star general and highest-ranking woman to graduate from West Point.
It goes without saying you're pretty happy the Army is considering changing all the names, right?
Absolutely. I think it's important because that's what message are we sending?
When you
had your epiphany. Before that, had you ever thought what it might be like for black officers to walk around those bases?
I'd never thought of it. And listen, I one of the reasons that I'm so passionate about this, I hold myself responsible for this. I didn't see what was, I've had black bosses, I've got black friends, but I didn't understand what it meant.
Sedgley wrote about his evolution in his book, Robert E. Lee and Me, A Southerner's Reckoning with the Myth of a Lost Cause.
History is dangerous because it goes after our myth and our identity. And what I was doing was challenging the Army and West Point about who it is and what it wants to be. And now I am so happy. The Army is leading the way. It can't wait to change. West Point, they already got a plan.
Are you changing history?
We're changing commemoration. History is what historians do to look at the past to try to understand what happened. But commemoration is who as a society do we honor? And we should honor those who live the values that we cherish today, not those who fought for slavery and treason 160 years ago.
But that battle is not over. As the country witnessed on January 6th, those symbols of the past are still very much alive today.
When you saw that Confederate battle flag, and I think people don't understand the difference between a Confederate flag, Confederate battle flag.
It's the flag of treason. That's what I call it. And when I saw the flag of treason go by there, I tell you, I was ready to put my uniform back on and go there and say, because listen, we don't do rebellion in the United States of America. We don't do insurrection.
It was a surreal nature to it. Is this really happening in the United States of America?
Any final thoughts on where we'll be as a country, where the Army will be after this changes?
Well, Martha, I'm the eternal optimist. We've seen so much improvement. I think we can get there. Maybe now that their eyes are open and we can have a better dialogue.
That is all for us today. Check out World News Tonight, and I'll see you tomorrow on GMA.
ABC News, honored winner for the second straight year with the Edward R. Murrow Award for Overall Excellence in Television. ABC News, America's number one news source.